said with confidence 2 weeks earlier was a lot more speculative now. It actually made sense to the Americans. Clark thought for a second before speaking. "You'd better shake the tree, Boris Ilyich. We both need that man." "Did you compromise him?" the Russian asked. "No, not at all. We told him to act as he normally would. And besides, he thinks we're Russians. I had no instructions other than to check him out, and trying to direct a guy like that is too risky. He's just as liable to turn super patriot on us and tell us to shove it. People like that, you just let them do the right thing all by themselves." Sharenko reflected again that the file in Moscow Center on this man was correct. Clark had all the right instincts for field intelligence work. He nodded and waited for Clark to go on. "If you have PSID under your control, we need to find out immediately if they have the man."
"And if they do?"
Clark shrugged. "Then you have to decide if you can get him out. That part of the operation is yours. I can't make that call for you. But if it's somebody else who bagged him, then maybe we can do something."
"I need to talk to Moscow. We figure that.
Just remember, Koga's our best chance for a political solution to this mess. Next, get the word to Washington."
"It will be done," Sharenko promised. "I need to ask a question. The two aircraft that crashed last night."
Clark and Chavez were already on the way out the door. It was the younger man who spoke without turning. "A terrible accident, wasn't it?"
"You're insane," Mogaturo Koga said. "I am a patriot," Raizo Yamata replied. "I will make our country truly independent. I will make Japan great again."
Their eyes met from opposite ends of the table in Yamata's penthouse apartment. The executive's security people were outside the door. These words were for two men alone.
"You have cast away our most important ally and trading partner. You are bringing economic ruin to us. You've killed people. You've suborned our country's government and our military."
Yamata nodded as though acknowledging a property acquisition.
I have done all these things, and it was not difficult.
Tell me, Koga, how hard is it to get a politician to do anything?"
"And your friends, Matsuda and the rest. Everyone needs guidance from time to time."
"Almost everyone," Yamata didn't say.
"At the end of this, we will have a fully integrated economy, two firm and powerful allies, and in time we will again have our trade because the rest of the world needs us."
Didn't this politician see that? Didn't he understand?
"Do you understand America as poorly as that? Our current difficulties began because a single family was burned alive. They are not the same as us. They think differently. Their religion is different. They have the most violent culture in the world, yet they worship justice. They venerate making money, but their roots are found in ideals. Can't you grasp that? They will not tolerate what you have done."
Koga paused.
"And your plan for Russia? Do you really think that,
with China helping us," Yamata smiled, "the two of us can handle Russia?"
"And China will remain our ally?" Koga asked. "We killed 20 million Chinese in the Second World War, and their political leadership has not forgotten. They need us, and they know they need us, and together, Yamata-san,"
Koga said quietly, politely, because it was his nature.
"You do not understand politics as well as you understand business. It will be your downfall."
Yamata replied in kind.
"And treason will be yours. I know you have contacts with the Americans."
"Not so. I have not spoken with an American citizen in weeks."
An indignant reply would not have carried the power of the matter-of-fact tone.
"Well, in any case, you will be my guest here for the time being," Raizo told him. "We will see how ignorant of political matters I am. In 2 years I will be Prime Minister Koga-san. In 2 years we will be a superpower."
Yamata stood. His apartment covered the entire top floor of the 40-story building, and the Olympian view pleased him. The industrialist stood and walked toward the floor-to-ceiling windows, surveying the city which would soon be his capital. What a pity that Koga didn't understand how things really worked. But for the moment he had to fly back to Saipan to begin his political ascendancy. He turned back.
You will see. You are my guest for the moment. Behave yourself and you will be treated well. Attempt to escape and your body will be found in pieces on some railroad tracks, along with a note apologizing for your political failures.
You will not have that satisfaction, the former Prime Minister replied coldly. Chapter 40 Foxes and Hounds. Cherenko had planned to do the meet himself, but urgent business had prevented him from doing so. It turned out to be just as well. The message, delivered via computer disk, was from his top agent in place, the deputy director of the PSID. Whatever the man's personal habits, he was a canny political observer, if somewhat verbose in his reports and evaluations. The Japanese military, he said, was not the least displeased by their immediate prospects. Frustrated by years of having been labeled as a self-defense force and relegated in the public's mind to getting in the way of Godzilla and other unlikely monsters, usually to their misfortune, they deemed themselves custodians of a proud warrior tradition, and now, finally, with political leadership worthy of their mettle, their command leadership relished the chance to show what they could do. Mainly products of American training and professional education, the senior officers had made their estimate of the situation and announced to everyone who would listen that they could and would win this limited contest. And, the PSID director went on, they thought the chances of conquering Siberia were excellent. This evaluation and the report from the two CIA officers were relayed to Moscow at once. So there was dissension in the Japanese government, and at least one of its professional departments had a slight grasp on reality. It was gratifying to the Russian, but he also remembered how a German intelligence chief named Canaris had done much the same thing in 1939, and had completely failed to accomplish anything. It was an historical model that he intended to break. The trick with wars was to prevent them from growing large. Cherenko didn't hold with the theory that diplomacy could keep them from starting, but he did believe that good intelligence and decisive action could keep them from going too far, if you had the political will to take the proper action. It worried him, however, that it was Americans who had to show that will. "It's called Operation Zorro, Mr. President," Robbie Jackson said, flipping the cover off the first chart. The Secretaries of State and Defense were there in the Situation Room along with Ryan and Arnie Van Dam. The two cabinet secretaries were ill at ease right now, but then so was the Deputy J-3. Ryan nodded for him to go on. "The mission is to dislocate the command leadership of the other side by precisely targeting those individuals who..." "You mean murder them?" Brett Hansen asked. He looked over at SecDef, who didn't react at all. "Mr. Secretary, we don't want to engage their civilian population. That means we cannot attack their economy. We can't drop bridges in their cities. Their military is too decentralized in location to..." "We can't do this," Hansen interrupted again.
"Mr. Secretary," Ryan said coolly, "can we at least hear what the plan is before we decide what we should and should not do?"
Hansen nodded gruffly, and Jackson continued his brief.
"The pieces," he concluded, "are largely in place now. We've eliminated two of their air surveillance assets."
"When did that happen? How did we do it?"
"It happened last night," Ryan answered. "How we did it is not your concern, sir."
"Who ordered it?"
This question came from President Durling.
"I did, sir. It was well covered, and the operation went off without a hitch."
Durling replied with his eyes that Ryan was pushing his limits again.
"How many people did that kill?" the Secretary of State demanded.
"About 50, and that's 200 or so less than the number of our people whom they killed, Mr. Secretary."
"Look, we can talk them out of the islands if we just take the time," Sec State said, and now the argument was bilateral with all the others watching.
"That's not what Adler says."
"Chris Cook thinks so, and he's got a guy inside their delegation." Derling watched impassively, again letting his staff people, that's how he thought of them, handle the debate. For him, there were other questions. Politics would again raise its ugly head. If he failed to respond to the crisis effectively, then he was out. Someone else would be president then, and that someone else would be faced in the following year, at the latest, with a wider crisis. Even worse, if the Russian intelligence estimates were correct, and if Japan and China made their move on Siberia in the coming autumn, then another larger crisis would strike during an American election cycle, seriously impeding his country's ability to deal with it, making everything a political debate, with an economy still trying to recover from a $100 billion trade shortfall. "If we fail to act now, Mr. Secretary, there's no telling how far this thing might go," Ryan was saying now. "We can work this out diplomatically," Hansen insisted.
"And if not?" Derling asked.
"Then in due course we can consider a measured military response." Sec-State's confidence was not reflected in Sec-Def's expression.
"You have something to add?" the President asked him.
"It will be some time, years, before we can assemble the forces necessary to..."
"We don't have years," Ryan snapped.
"No, I don't think that we do," Derling observed. "Admiral, will it work?"
"I think it can, sir. We need a few breaks to come our way, but we got the biggest one last night." "We don't have the necessary forces to assure success," Sec-Def said. "The task force commander just sent in his estimate, and I've seen it," Jackson said, not quite able to conceal his uneasiness at the truth of the report. "But I know the CAG, Captain Bud Sanchez. Known him for years, and he says he can do it, and I believe him. Mr. President, don't be overly affected by the numbers. It isn't about numbers. It's about fighting a war. And we have more experience in that than they do. It's about psychology and playing to our strengths rather than theirs. War isn't what it used to be. Used to be you needed huge forces to destroy the enemy's capacity to fight and his ability to coordinate and command his forces. Okay, 50 years ago you needed a lot to do that. But the targets you want to hit are actually very small. And if you can hit those small targets, you accomplish the same thing now as you used to need 1 million men to do before."
"It's cold-blooded murder," Hansen snarled. "That's what it is."
Jackson turned from his place at the lectern. "Yes, sir, that's exactly what war is. But this way you're not killing some poor 19-year-old son of a bitch who joined up because he liked the uniform. We're going to kill the bastard who sent him out to die and doesn't even know his name. With all due respect, sir, I have killed people, and I know exactly what it feels like. Just once, just one time, I'd like a crack at the people who give the orders instead of the poor, dumb bastards who are stuck with carrying them out."
Derling almost smiled at that, remembering all the fantasies and even a TV commercial once about how different it might be if the president and prime ministers and other senior officials who ordered men off to the field of battle instead met and slugged it out personally.
"You're still going to have to kill a lot of kids," the president said. Admiral Jackson drew back from his angry demeanor before answering.
"I know that, sir, but with luck, a lot less."
"When do you have to know?"
"The pieces are largely in place now. We can initiate the operation in less than 5 hours. After that, we're daylight limited. 24-hour intervals after that."
"Thank you, Admiral Jackson. Could you all excuse me for a few minutes?" The men filed out until Derling had another thought. "Jack, could you stay a minute?"
Ryan turned and sat back down. "It had to be done, sir, one way or another, if we're going to take those nukes out."
"I know."
The president looked down at his desk. All the briefing papers and maps and charts were spread out, all the order of battle documents. At least he'd been spared the casualty estimates, probably at Ryan's direction. After a second, they heard the door close. Ryan spoke first.
"Sir, there's one other thing.
former Prime Minister Koga has been arrested. Excuse me, we only know that he's kinda disappeared.
What does that mean? Why didn't you bring that up before?
The arrest happened less than 24 hours after I told Scott Adler that Koga had been contacted. I didn't even tell him whom he'd been in contact with. Now, that could be a coincidence. Goto and his master just might not want him making political noise while they carry out their operation. It could also mean that there's a leak somewhere.
Who on our side knows?
Ed and Mary Pat at CIA, me, you, Scott Adler, and whomever Scott told.
But we don't know for sure that there's a leak.
No, sir, we don't, but it is extremely likely.
Set it aside for now. What if we don't do anything?
Sir, we have to. If we don't, then sometime in the future you can expect a war between Russia on one hand and Japan and China on the other, with us doing God knows what. CIA is still trying to do its estimate, but I don't see how the war can fail to go nuclear. Zorro may not be the prettiest thing we've ever tried to do, but it's the best chance we have. The diplomatic issues are not important, Ryan went on. We're playing for much higher stakes now. But if we can kill off the guys who initiated this mess, then we can cause Goto's government to fall, and then we can get things back under some sort of control. The odd part, Durling realized, was the trade-off concerning which side was pitching which sort of moderation. Hansen and SecDef took the classical diplomatic line. They wanted to take the time to be sure there was no other option to resolve the crisis through peaceful means. But if diplomacy failed, then the door was opened for a much wider and bloodier conflict. Ryan and Jackson wanted to apply violence at once in the hope of avoiding a wider war later. The hell of it was, either side could be right or wrong, and the only way to know for sure was to read the history books 20 years from now.
If the plan doesn't work, then we've killed some of our people for nothing, Jack said honestly.
You will pay a fairly high price yourself, sir.
What about the fleet commander? I mean the guy commanding the carrier group. What about him?
If he chokes, the whole thing comes apart.
Replace him, the president said. The mission is approved.
There was one other item to be discussed. Ryan walked the president through that one, too, before leaving the room and making his phone calls. The perfect Air Force mission, people in blue uniforms like to say, was run by a mere captain. This one was commanded locally by a special operations colonel, but at least he was a man who'd been recently passed over for general's rank, a fact that endeared him to his subordinates who knew why he'd failed to screen for flag rank. People in Spec Ops just didn't fit in with the button-down ideal of senior leadership. They were too eccentric for that. The final mission brief evolved from data sent by real-time link from Fort Meade, Maryland to Varino, and the Americans still cringed at the knowledge that Russians were learning all sorts of things about America's ability to gather and analyze electronic data via satellite and other means. After all, the capability had been developed for use against them. The exact positions of two operating E-767s were precisely plotted. Visual satellite data had counted fighter aircraft, at least those not in protective shelters, and the orbiting KH-12's last pass had counted airborne aircraft and their positions. The colonel commanding the detachment went over the penetration course that he had personally worked out with the flight crew, and while there were worries, the two young captains who would fly the C-17A transport chewed their gum and nodded final approval. One of them even joked about how it was time a trash hauler got a little respect. The Russians had their part to play, too. From Vuzhno-Skolinsk south on the Kamchatka Peninsula, 8 MiG-31 interceptors lifted off for an air defense exercise, accompanied by an IL-86 mainstay airborne early warning aircraft. 4 Sukhoi fighters took off 10 minutes later from Sokol to act as aggressors. The Sukhois, with long-range fuel tanks, headed southeast, remaining well outside Japanese airspace. The controllers in both Japanese E-767s recognized it for what it was, a fairly typical and stylized Russian training exercise. Nevertheless, it did involve warplanes and merited their close attention.
all the more so that it was astride the most logical approach route for American aircraft like the B-1s that had so recently tickled their air defenses. It had the effect of drawing the E-767s both north and east somewhat, and with them their fighter escorts. The reserve AWACS aircraft was almost ordered aloft, but the ground-based air defense commander decided sensibly merely to increase his alert state a bit. The C-17A Globemaster III was the newest and most expensive air transport aircraft ever to force its way through the Pentagon's procurement system. Anyone familiar with that procedural nightmare would have preferred FLAC, because at least bombing missions were designed to succeed, whereas the procurement system seemed most often designed to fail. That it didn't was a tribute of sorts to the ingenuity of the people dedicated to confounding it. No expense had been spared, and a few new ones located for use. But what had resulted was a trash hauler, the term most often used by fighter pilots, with pretensions of the wildlife. This one took off just after local midnight, heading south-southwest, as though it were a civil flight to Vladivostok. Just short of that city, it took fuel from a KC-135 tanker. The Russian mid-air refueling system was not compatible with American arrangements, and departed the Asian mainland, now heading due south, exactly on the 132nd meridian. The Globemaster was the first ever cargo aircraft designed with special operations in mind. The normal flight crew of only two was supplemented with two observer positions, for which modular instrument packages were provided. In this case, both were electronics warfare officers now keeping tabs on the numerous air defense radar sites that littered the Russian, Chinese, Korean, and Japanese coasts, and directing the flight crew to thread their way through as many null areas as possible. That soon required a rapid descent and a turn east. "Don't you just love this?" First Sergeant Vega asked his commander. The Rangers were sitting on fold-down seats in the cargo area, dressed in combat gear that had made them waddle like ducks aboard the aircraft an hour earlier under the watchful eyes of the loadmaster. It was widely believed within the Army's airborne community that the Air Force awarded points to its flight crews for making their passengers barf. But in this case, there would be no complaints. The most dangerous part of the mission was right now, despite their parachutes, something the Air Force crewmen significantly didn't bother with. They would be of little use in any case should a stray fighter happen upon their transport at almost any time up to the programmed jump. Captain Cheka just nodded, mainly wishing he were on the ground where an infantryman belonged, instead of sitting as helpless as an unborn child in the womb of a woman addicted to disco dancing. Forward, the EWO displays were coloring up. The rectangular TV-type tube displayed a computer memory of every known radar installation on Japan's western coast. It hadn't been hard to input the information, as most of them had been established a generation or two earlier by Americans, back when Japan had been a massive island base for use against the Soviet Union, and liable to Russian attack for that reason. The radars had been upgraded along the way, but any picket line had its imperfections, and these had been mostly known to the Americans beforehand, and then re-evaluated by Elint satellites in the last week. The aircraft was heading southeast now, leveling out 200 feet over the water and tooling along at its maximum low-level speed of 350 knots. It made for a very bumpy ride, which the flight crew didn't notice, though everyone else did. The pilot wore low-light goggles and swept his head around the sky while the co-pilot concentrated on the instruments. The latter crewman was also provided with a head-up display, just like that on a fighter. It displayed compass heading, altitude, airspeed, and also gave him a thin green line to indicate the horizon, which he could sometimes see, depending on the state of the moon and clouds. "I have strobes very high at 10 o'clock, the pilot reported. Those would be airliners on a standard commercial routing. Nothing else. The co-pilot gave her screen another look. The radar plot was exactly as programmed, with their flight path following a very narrow corridor of black amid radial spikes of red and yellow, which indicated areas covered by defense and air control radars. The lower they flew, the wider was the black safe zone, but they were already as low as they could safely fly.
50 miles off the coast.
Roger, the pilot acknowledged. How are you doing? He asked a second later. Low-level penetrations were stressful on everyone, even with a computer-controlled autopilot handling the stick work.
No prob, she replied.
It wasn't exactly true, but it was the thing she was supposed to say.
The most dangerous part was right here, passing the elevated radar site at Aikawa.
The weakest part of Japan's low-level defense perimeter, it was a gap between a peninsula and an island. Radars on both beams almost covered the 70-mile gap, but they were old ones, dating back to the 1970s and had not been upgraded with the demise of the communist regime in North Korea.
Easing down, she said next, adjusting the altitude control on the autopilot to 70 feet.
Theoretically, they could fly safely at 50 over a flat surface, but their aircraft was riding heavy, and now her hand was on the side stick control, itself another illusion that this was actually a fighter plane. If she saw so much as a fishing boat, she'd have to yank the aircraft to higher altitude for fear of a collision with somebody's masthead.
Coast in 5, one of the electronic warfare officers announced. Recommend come right to 165.
Coming right. The aircraft banked slightly.
There were only a few windows in the cargo area. First Sergeant Vega had one and looked out to see the wingtip of the aircraft dip toward a barely perceived black surface dotted with the occasional white cap. The sight made him turn back in. He couldn't help things anyway, and if they hit and cartwheeled in, he'd have no time at all to comprehend it, or so he'd been told once.
I got the coast, the pilot said, catching the glow of lights first through his goggles. It was time to switch them off and help fly the aircraft.
My airplane.
Pilot's airplane, the co-pilot acknowledged, flexing her hand and allowing herself a deep breath.
They crossed the coast between Omi and Ichifuri. As soon as land was visible, the pilot started climbing the aircraft. The automated terrain avoidance system had 3 settings. He selected the one labeled hard, which was rough on the airplane and rougher on the passengers, but ultimately safer for all concerned.
What about their AWACS? He asked the EWOs.
I've got emissions on 1, 9 o'clock, very weak. If you keep us in the weeds, we'll be okay.
Get out the barf bags, guys.
To the loadmaster.
10 minutes.
10 minutes, the Air Force sergeant announced in the back. Just then, the aircraft lurched up and to the right, dodging around the first coastal mountain. Then it dropped down rapidly again like a particularly unpleasant amusement park ride, and Julio Vega remembered once swearing that he'd never subject himself to anything like this again. It was a promise that had been broken many times, but this time, again, there were people on the ground with guns. And they weren't Colombian druggies this time, but a trained professional army.
"Jesus, I hope they give us 2 minutes of easy ride to walk to the door," he said between gulps.
"Don't count on it," Captain Chaco said, just before he used his barf bag. It started a series of such events among the other rangers.
The trick was to keep mountaintops between them and the radar transmitters. That meant flying in valleys. The Globemaster was slower now, barely 230 knots of indicated airspeed, and even with flaps and slats extended, and even with a computer-aided flight control system, it made for a ride that wallowed on one hand and jerked on the other, something that changed from 1 second to the next. The head-up display now showed the mountainous corridor they were flying, with red warning messages appearing before the eyes of the pilots that the autopilot handled quite well, thank you, but not without leading the two drivers in their front seats to genuine fear. Aviators never really trusted the things, and now 2 hands were on their stick controllers, almost flinching and taking control away from the computer, but not quite, in what was almost a highly sophisticated game of chicken, with the computer trying in its way to outgut the trained aviators who had to trust the microchips to do things their own reflexes were unable to match. They watched green jagged lines that represented real mountains, ranks of them, fuzzy on the edges from the trees that grew to the tops of most. And for the most part, the lines were well above the flight level of their aircraft until the last second, when the nose would jerk upwards and their stomachs would struggle to catch up, and then the aircraft would dive again.
"There's the IP. 5 minutes," the pilot called aft. "Stand up," the loadmaster yelled at his passengers. The aircraft was going down again, and one of the Rangers almost came off the floor of the aircraft when he stood. They moved aft toward the portside passenger door, which was now opened. As they hooked up their static lines, the rear cargo hatch dropped down, and two Air Force enlisted men removed the safety hooks from the palletized cargo that occupied the middle of the 65-foot cargo bay. The Globemaster leveled out one last time, and out the door, Cheka and Vega could see the shadowy valley below their aircraft and a towering mountain to the left of them. 500 feet, the pilot said over intercom. "Let's get it done." "Winds look good," the co-pilot announced, checking the computer that controlled drops. "1 minute." The green light by the passenger door turned on. The loadmaster had a safety belt attached to his waist, standing by the door, blocking the way of the Rangers. He gave them a sideways look. "You guys be careful down there, you hear?" "Sorry about the mess," Captain Chaker said. The loadmaster grinned. "I've cleaned up worse. Besides, he had a private to do that." He gave the area a final check. The Rangers were safely in their places, and nobody was in the way of the cargo's roller path. The first drop would be done from the front office. "All clear aft," he said over his intercom circuit. The loadmaster stepped away from the door, allowing Cheka to take his place, one hand on either side and his left foot just over the edge. 10 seconds, the co-pilot said forward. "Roger, 10 seconds. The pilot reached for the release switch, flipping off the safety cover and resting his thumb on the toggle. 5, 5, 3, 2, 1... "Now, cargo away." The pilot had already flipped it at the proper moment. Aft, the Rangers saw the pallets slide out through the cavernous door. The aircraft took a major dip at the tail, then snapped back level. A second after that, the green light at the door started blinking. "Go, go, go!" the loadmaster screamed over the noise. Captain Diego Cheka, U.S. Army Rangers, became the first American to invade the Japanese mainland when he took his step out the door and fell into the darkness. A second later, the static line yanked his chute open, and the black nylon umbrella came to full blossom a bare 300 feet from the ground. The stiff and often hurtful opening shock came as a considerable relief. Jumping at 500 feet made the use of a backup chute a useless extravagance. He first looked up and to his right to see that the others were all out, their chutes opening as his had just done. The next order of business was to look down and around. There was the clearing, and he was sure he'd hit it, though he pulled on one riser to spill air from his parachute in the hope of hitting the middle of it and increasing the safety margin that was as much theoretical as real for a night drop. Last of all, he released his pack, which fell 15 feet to the end of a safety line. Its 60 pounds of gear would hit the ground first, lessening his landing shock so long as he didn't land right on the damn thing and break something in the process. Aside from that, he barely had time to think before the barely visible valley raced up to greet him. Feet together, knees bent, back straight, roll when you hit. The sudden lung-emptying shock of striking the ground, and then he was on his face, trying to decide if all his bones were intact or not. Seconds later, he heard the muted thuds and oofs of the rest of the detail as they also made it to Earth. Cheka allowed himself a full 3 seconds to decide that he was more or less in one piece before standing, unclipping his pack, and racing to collapse his chute. That task done, he came back, donned his low-light goggles, and assembled his people. "Everybody okay?" "Good drop, sir." Vega showed up first, with two others in tow. The rest were heading in, all carrying their black chutes. "Let's get to work, Rangers." The Globemaster continued almost due south, going feet wet just west of Namazu, and again hugging the water, kept a mountainous peninsula between itself and the distant E-767s for as long as possible, then turned southwest to distance itself further still from them, until 200 miles off the coast of Japan, it was safe to climb back to a safe cruising altitude into commercial airline routing G-223. The only remaining question was whether the KC-10 tanker that was supposed to meet them would show up,
and allow them to complete their flight to Kwajalein. Only then could they break radio silence. The Rangers were able to do it first. The communications sergeant broke out a satellite transmitter, oriented it toward the proper azimuth, and transmitted a five-letter group, waiting for an acknowledgment. "They're down okay," an Army major told Jackson at his desk in the National Military Command Center. The real trick is going to be getting them out, the admiral thought, but one thing at a time. He lifted his phone to call the White House. "Jack, the Rangers are in." "Good one, Rob. I need you over here," Ryan told him. "What for? It's busy here." "Now, Robbie." The line clicked off. The next order of business was to get the cargo moved. It had landed within 200 meters of the nominal location, and the plan had allowed for quite a bit more than that. One by one, pairs of Rangers struggled with empty fuel bladders, carrying them uphill to the tree line that bordered what seemed to be a highlands meadow. With that done, a hose was strung, and 20,000 pounds of JP-5 pumped from one large rubber bladder into six other smaller ones arranged in pairs at pre-selected spots. That operation took an hour, while four of their number patrolled the immediate area for signs of human presence, but finding nothing but the tracks of a four-wheel cycle, which they'd been told to expect. When the pumping operation was finished, the original fuel bladder was folded and dumped into a hole, then carefully covered up with sod. Next, the solid cargo had to be manhandled into place and covered with camouflage netting. That required another 2 hours, straining the Rangers to the limit of their conditioning, with the combination of heavy work and building stress. Soon the sun would be up, and the area could not look as though there were people here. First Sergeant Vega supervised the cover-up operation. When all was done, the Rangers, still outside the tree line, walked in single file toward it, with the last man in line working on the grass to reduce the signs of their passage. It wasn't perfect, but it would have to do. By dawn, at the end of what had been for them a 24-hour day, as unpleasant as anyone could have contrived to make, they were in place, unwelcome guests on the soil of a foreign land, mainly shivering in the cold, unable to light a fire for warmth, eating cold MRE rations. "Jack, I've got work to do over there, damn it," Robbie said on his way through the door. "Not anymore. The President and I talked it over last night."
"What do you mean?"
"Get packed. You're taking over the Stennis Battle Group." Ryan wanted to grin at his friend, but couldn't quite bring himself to that. Not when he was sending his friend into danger. The news stopped Jackson in his tracks. "You sure?" "It's decided. The President has signed off on it. SyncPak knows. Admiral Seaton..." Robbie nodded. "Yeah, I've worked for him before." "You have 2 hours. There's a Gulfstream waiting for you at Andrews." "We need somebody," the National Security Advisor explained, "who knows the political limits on the mission. Take it right to the edge, Rob, but no further. We have to smart our way through this." "I understand." Ryan stood and walked to his friend. "I'm not sure I like doing this."
"It's my job, Jack."
Tennessee arrived at her station off the Japanese coast and finally slowed to her normal patrol speed of 5 knots. Commander Claggett took a required moment to get a position fix on a rocky outcropping known to sailors as Lot's Wife, then dived his boat below the layer to a depth of 600 feet. The sonar showed nothing at the moment, odd for the normally busy shipping lanes. But after 4.5 days of dangerously high-speed running, it came as a considerable relief to everyone aboard. The Army personnel had adapted well enough and joined sailors for their jogs in the missile room. For the moment, the mission orders were little different from those the boomer had been designed to do. Remain undetected, with the additional assignment of gathering whatever information on enemy movements that came her way. It wasn't exactly exciting, but only Claggett knew at the moment how important it was. The satellite link told Sandy Richter and his colleagues that the mission was a probable go. It meant more simulator time for all of them while ground crews prepped their Comanches for business. Unfortunately, that meant affixing decidedly unstealthy wing fittings to the side of each aircraft,
along with long-range ferry tanks. But he'd known that from the beginning, and nobody had bothered asking how much he liked the idea. There were three scenarios on the sim now, and one by one the flight crews went through them, their bodies gyrating, quite unaware of what they were doing in the real world, while their minds and bodies played in the virtual one.
"How the hell do we do that?" Chavez demanded.
Russians would not have questioned the orders in quite that way, Cherenko thought.
"I only relay orders from your own agency," he told them. "I also know that Koga's disappearance was not caused by any official agency."
"Yamata, you suppose?" Clark asked. That piece of information narrowed the possibilities somewhat. It also made the impossible merely dangerous.
"A good guess. You know where he lives, yes?"
"We've seen it from a distance," Chavez confirmed.
"Ah, yes. Your photos."
The major would have loved to know what those had been about, but it would have been foolish to ask the question, and it was not certain that these two Americans knew the answers in any case.
"If you have other assets in country, I suggest you make use of them. We are making use of ours as well. Koga is probably the political solution to this crisis."
"If there is one," Ding noted.
"Good to fly with you again, Captain Sato," Yamata said pleasantly.
The invitation to the flight deck pleased him. The pilot, he saw, was a patriot, a man of both pride and skill, who really understood what was happening. What a pity he'd chosen such a lowly path for his life. Sato took off his headset and relaxed in his command seat.
"This is a pleasant change from the Canadian flights."
"How does that go?"
"I've spoken with a few executives on the way home. They say the Americans are more confused than anything else."
"Yes," Yamata smiled. "They confuse easily."
"Can we hope for a diplomatic settlement to this business, Yamata-san?"
"I think so. They lack the ability to attack us effectively."
"My father commanded a destroyer in the war." "My brother..."
"Yes, I know him well, Captain."
That remark, he saw, lit up the pilot's eyes with pride.
"And my son is a fighter pilot. He flies the Eagle."
"Well, they have done well so far. They recently killed two American bombers, you know."
"The Americans tested our air defenses," the industrialist said.
"It was they who failed."
Chapter 41 CTF 77
"You're back," the rental agent said with some pleasure. Nomuri smiled and nodded.
"Yes, I had a particularly good day at the office yesterday. I do not need to tell you how stressful such a good day can be, do I?"
The man grunted agreement.
"In the summer, my best days are those when I get no sleep. Please excuse how I appear," he added. He'd been working on some of his machines all morning, which for him had begun just after 5. The same was true of Nomuri, but for a different reason.
"I understand. I own my own business, too, and who works harder than a man who works for himself, eh?"
"Do you suppose the Zaibatsu understand that?"
"Not the ones I've met. Even so, you are fortunate to live in so peaceful an area."
"Not always peaceful. The Air Force must have been playing games last night. A jet flew close by and very low. It woke me up, and I never really got back to sleep afterward."
He wiped his hands and poured 2 cups of tea, offering one to his guest.
"Dozo," Nomuri said graciously.
"They are playing very dangerous games now," he went on, wondering what response he'd get.
"It's madness. But who cares what I think? Not the government, surely. All they listen to are the great ones."
The equipment owner sipped at his tea and looked around his shop.
"Yes, I am concerned, too. I hope Goto can find a way out of this before things spin completely out of control."
Nomuri looked outside. The weather was turning gray and threatening. He heard a decidedly angry grunt.
"Goto! Just one more like all the rest. Others lead him by the nose. Or some other part, if the rumors about him are correct."
Nomuri chuckled.
Yes, I have heard the stories, too. Still, a man of some figure, eh? He paused. So, can I rent another of your cycles today? Take number 6, the man pointed. I just finished servicing it. Pay attention to the weather, he warned. Snow tonight. Namuri held up his backpack. I want to take some pictures of cloudy mountains for my collection. The peace here is wonderful and fine for thinking. Only in the winter, the dealer said, returning to his work. Namuri knew the way now and followed the Taki uphill over a trail crusty from cold and frost. He would have felt a little better about it if the damn four-wheeled cycle had a better muffler. At least the heavy air would help attenuate the sound, or so he hoped, as he headed up the same path he'd taken a few days earlier. In due course, he was looking down at the high meadow, seeing nothing out of the ordinary, and wondering a lot of things. What if the soldiers had run into an ambush? In that case, Namuri told himself, I'm toast. But there was no turning back. He settled back into the seat and steered his way down the hillside, stopping, as he was supposed to, in the middle of the clearing and taking the downed hood off his red parka. On closer examination, he saw that some sod had been disturbed, and he saw what might have been a trail of some sorts into the woodline. That was when a single figure appeared, waving him up. The CIA officer restarted the cycle and headed that way. The two soldiers who confronted him didn't point weapons. They didn't have to. Their faces were painted, and their camouflage uniforms told them everything he needed to know. I'm Namuri, he said. The password is Foxtrot. Captain Cheka, the officer replied, extending his hand. We've worked with the agency before. Are you the guy who picked this spot? No, but I checked it out a couple of days ago. Nice place to build a cabin, Cheka thought. We even saw a few deer, little ones. I hope it isn't hunting season. The remark caught Namuri short. He hadn't considered that possibility and didn't know anything about hunting in Japan. So, what do you have for me? These. Namuri took off his backpack and pulled out the cellular phones. Are you kidding me? The Japanese military has good stuff for monitoring military communications. Hell, they invented a lot of the technology our people use. But these, Namuri grinned. Everybody has them, and they're digitally encrypted and they cover the whole country, even here. There's a repeater tower down on that mountain. Anyway, it's safer than using your regular comms. The bill's paid to the end of the month, he added. Be nice to call home and tell my wife that everything is going fine, Cheka thought aloud. I'd be careful about that. Here are the numbers you can call. Namuri handed over a sheet. That one's mine. That one's a guy named Clark. That one's another officer named Chavez. Ding's over here? First Sergeant Vega asked. You know him? We did a job in Africa last fall, Cheka replied. We get a lot of special work. You sure you can tell us their names, man? They have covers. You're probably better off speaking in Spanish. Not as many people here speak that language. I don't need to tell you to keep your transmission short, Namuri added. He didn't. Cheka nodded and asked the most important question. And getting out? Namuri turned to point, but the terrain feature in question was covered in clouds. There's a pass there. Head for it, then downhill to a town called Hirose. I pick you up there, put you on a train to Nagoya, and you fly off to either Taiwan or Korea. Just like that. The comment wasn't posed as a question, but the dubious nature of the response was clear anyway. There are a couple of 100,000 foreign business people here. You're 11 guys from Spain trying to sell wine, remember? I could use some sangria right now, too. Cheka was relieved to see that his CIA contact had been briefed in on the same mission. It didn't always work out that way. Now what? You wait for the rest of the mission force to arrive. If something goes wrong, you call me and head out. If I drop out of the net, you call the others. If everything goes to hell, you find another way out. You should have passports, clothes, and...
We do.
Good. Namuri took his camera out of his backpack and started shooting photos of the cloud-shrouded mountains. This is CNN live from Pearl Harbor, the reporter ended, and a commercial cut in. The intelligence analyst rewound the tape to examine it again. It was both amazing and entirely ordinary that he'd be able to get such vital information so easily.
The American media really ran the country, he'd learned over the years, and perhaps more was the pity. The way they'd played up the unfortunate incident in Tennessee had inflamed the entire country into precipitous action, then driven his country into the same, and the only good news was what he saw on the TV screen. Two fleet carriers still in their dry docks, with two more still in the Indian Ocean, according to the latest reports from that part of the world, and Pacific Fleet's other two in Long Beach also dry docked and unable to enter service. And that really was that, so far as the Marianas were concerned. He had to formalize his intelligence estimate with a few pages of analytical prose, but what it came down to was that America could sting his country, but her ability to project real power was now a thing of the past. The realization of that meant that there was little likelihood of a serious contest for the immediate future. Jackson didn't mind being the only passenger on the VC-20B. A man could get used to this sort of treatment, and he had to admit that the Air Force's executive birds were better than the Navy's. In fact, the Navy didn't have many, and those were mainly modified P-3 Orions, whose turboprop engines provided barely more than half the speed of the twin-engine executive jet. With only a brief refueling stop at Travis Air Force Base outside San Francisco, he'd made the hop to Hawaii in under 9 hours, and it was something to feel good about. Until on final approach to Hickam, he got a good look at the naval base and saw that Enterprise was still in the graving dock. The first nuclear-powered carrier and bearer of the U.S. Navy's proudest name would be out of this one. The aesthetic aspect of it was bad enough. More to the point, it would have been far better to have two decks to use instead of one. "You have your task force, boy," Robbie whispered to himself. And it was the one every naval aviator wanted. Task Force 77, titularly the main air arm of Pacific Fleet, and one carrier or not, it was his, and about to sail in harm's way. Perhaps 50 years earlier there had been an excitement to it. Perhaps when Pac Fleet's main striking arm had sailed under Bill Halsey or Ray Spruance, the people in command had looked forward to it. The wartime movies said so, and so did the official logs. But how much of that had been mere posturing, Jackson wondered now, contemplating his own command. Did Halsey and Spruance lose sleep with the knowledge that they were sending young men to death? Or was the world simply a different place then, where war was considered as natural an event as a polio epidemic, another scourge that was now a thing of the past? To be Commander Task Force 77 was a life's ambition, but he'd never really wanted to fight a war. Oh, sure, he admitted to himself, as a new ensign, or even as far as lieutenant's rank, he'd relish the idea of air combat, knowing that as a U.S. naval aviator he was the best in the world, highly trained and exquisitely equipped, and wanting to prove it someday. But over time he'd seen too many friends die in action. He'd gotten a kill in the Persian Gulf War, and four more over the Med one clear and starry night. But those last four had been an accident. He'd killed men for no good reason at all, and though he never spoke of it to others, not even his wife, it gnawed at him that he had in effect been tricked into killing other human beings. Not his fault, just some sort of enforced mistake. But that's what war was for the warriors most of the time, just a huge mistake, and now he had to play his part in another such mistake. Instead of using TF-77 the way it was supposed to be used, just to be, and merely by being, to prevent wars from happening. The only consolation of the moment was that, again, the mistake, the accident, wasn't of his making. If wishes were horses, he told himself as the aircraft taxied to a stop. The flight attendant opened the door and tossed Jackson's one bag out to another Air Force sergeant who walked the admiral to a helicopter for his next flight, this one to SyncPAC, Admiral Dave Seaton. It was time to don his professional personality. Misused or not, Robbie Jackson was a warrior about to assume command of others. He'd examined his doubts and questions, and now it was time to put them away.
"We're going to owe them big time for this," Durling noted, flipping off the TV with his remote.
The technology had been developed for advertising during baseball games, of all things.
an adaptation of the blue screen systems used in the production of movies. Advanced computer systems allowed it to be used in real time, and thus the background behind the batter at the plate could be made to appear to be an advertisement for a local bank or car dealer, when in fact it was just the usual green used at ballparks. In this case, a reporter could make his or her live feed from Pearl Harbor, outside the naval base, of course, and the background was that of two carrier profiles with birds flying past and the ant-like shapes of yard workers moving in the distance, and it looked as real as anything else on the TV screen, which, after all, was just a collection of multicolored dots. "They're Americans," Jack said, and besides, he was the one who'd bullied them into it, again insulating the president from the politically dangerous task. "They're supposed to be on our side. We just had to remind them of that."
"Will it work?"
That was the harder question. "Not for long, but maybe for long enough. It's a good plan we have in place. We need a few breaks, but we've gotten two in the bag already. The important thing is we're showing them what they expect to see. They expect both carriers to be there, and they expect the media to tell the whole world about it. Intelligence people are no different from anybody else, sir. They have preconceptions, and when they see them in real life, it just reinforces how brilliant they think they are." "How many people do we have to kill?" the president wanted to know next. "Enough. We don't know how big the number is, and we're going to try and keep it as low as possible. But, sir, the mission is..."
I know about missions, remember?"
Durling closed his eyes, remembering infantry school at Fort Benning, Georgia, half a lifetime before. "The mission comes first. It was the only way a lieutenant could think, and now, for the first time, he realized that a president had to think the same way. It hardly seemed fair. They didn't see much sun this far north at this time of year, and that suited Colonel Zacharias. The flight from Whiteman to Elmendorf had taken a mere 5 hours, all of it in darkness, because the B-2A flew only in daylight to show itself to people, which was not something for which the aircraft had been conceived. It flew very well indeed, belated proof that Jack Northrop's idea, dating back to the 1930s, had been correct. An aircraft consisting exclusively of wing surfaces was the most efficient possible aerodynamic shape. It was just that the flight control systems required for such an aircraft needed computerized flight controls for proper stability, something that had not been available until just before the engineer's death. At least he'd seen the model, if not the actual aircraft itself. Almost everything about it was efficient. Its shape allowed easy storage. Three could fit in a hangar designed for one conventional aircraft. It climbed rather like an elevator, and able to cruise at high altitude, it drank its fuel in cups rather than gallons. Or so the wing commander liked to say. The shot-up B-1B was about ready to fly back to Elmendorf. It would do so on three engines, not a major problem, as the aircraft would be carrying nothing more than fuel and its crew as a payload. There were other aircraft based at Chemya now. Two E-3B AWACS birds dispatched from Tinker Air Force Base in Oklahoma maintained a partial airborne alert patrol, though this island had power radars of its own, the largest of which was the powerful Cobra Dane missile detection system built in the 1970s. There was the theoretical possibility that the Japanese could, using tankers, manage a strike against the island, duplicating in length an Israeli mission against the PLO headquarters in North Africa. And though the possibility was remote, it did have to be considered. Defending against that were the Air Force's only four F-22A Rapier fighters, the world's first true stealth fighter aircraft, taken from advanced testing at Nellis Air Force Base and dispatched with four senior pilots and their support crews to this base at the edge of the known universe. But the Rapier, known to the pilots by the name the manufacturer Lockheed had initially preferred, Lightning II, hadn't been designed for defense, and now, with the sun back down after its brief and fitful appearance, it was time for the original purpose. As always, the tanker lifted off first, even before the fighter pilots walked from the briefing hut to their aircraft shelters for the start of the night's work. "If he flew out yesterday, why are there lights on?" Chavez asked, looking up at the penthouse apartment. "Timer on the lights to scare burglars away?" John wondered lightly.
This ain't L.A., man. Then I suppose there's people there, Yevgeny Pavlovich. He turned the car onto another street. Okay, we know that Koga wasn't arrested by the local police. We know that Yamada is running this whole show. We know that his security chief, Kaneda, probably...